Hi, everybody. Happy Christmas. This is Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. We are excited to speak to composer Amelia Warner about her musical score to Wild Mountain Time? Wild Mountain Time.
Wild Time, yeah.
Amelia, we're thrilled to be speaking with you. I have a myriad of questions because you've done so much. You're kind of a big deal. I don't know how much the internet, if you know how much the internet loves you, but you're kind of an icon.
No. Come on, of what?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you're gifted musically. You have acting chops. You and your husband get some notoriety for being such an adorable couple. I was doing some research. I found it's kind of weird to go down rabbit holes, but there's an Amelia Warner Brazil YouTube page where people from Brazil post music videos of yours.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's cool.
You have adoring fans. Well, thank you for joining the show. I'm pretty excited to be speaking with you, especially because we're in a pandemic. It's great that we get a pick-me-up movie. We get something that's just pleasant and makes you feel good, which your music does. So I guess in order to get started, can we jump back to before you got into the music biz and talk a little bit about your acting?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But yeah, I started acting when I was about 16 when I did my first thing, and my mom was an actress. And so I'd kind of been around it, and it felt like, you know, it was kind of the family business, I guess, in a way. And it kind of felt like a natural step. And I really enjoyed plays and drama at school. And so I was doing lots of that along with also doing music. And so I started working, and I got really lucky kind of early on and did some really cool projects, and so did it for a few years, but to be honest, from very early on I felt like I knew it wasn't really going to be the right thing for me. And I get very, very nervous and self-conscious, and I you know, really struggle performing. And so I think I kind of, maybe when I was a teenager, I had maybe more bravado, or I could kind of get through that. And then the older I got, the more crippling I found it. And what I found was that I enjoyed every aspect of like being an actress, apart from the bit where you have to act. You know, I loved like traveling. I loved being part of a movie. I loved the collaboration. I loved working with these amazing people, and I just would watch everybody on set, and I was like, this is amazing. But whenever they said action, I would just freeze and I would just feel terror. So I kind of thought, well, this isn't right. You shouldn't be feeling like this. And this isn't the right thing for you. So I kind of made a decision. I mean, I was probably, you know, in my early 20s to kind of, you know, move on from it. But I knew I wanted to be in the film world and you know, work on films.
Well, I heard in an interview that you would kind of retreat to your trailer and you would mess around with music to,
yeah,
that's really your passion. Can you speak more to how these little hobbies became, you know, a fork road left to become a composer?
Yeah, I mean, it was weird because it's always with retrospect, isn't it, that you realize that the kind of clues were there all the time. I remember the very first thing I ever bought when I started earning money was a piano. And then when I had to travel, you know, I used to travel with a keyboard. And I remember, like, when I was an actress, I did a couple of jobs in Australia, and like having to check in this big keyboard and kind of, but never like questioning it, you know, because to me it was an essential thing. But I guess looking back on that, it's, you know, that probably was telling me something. And then I remember I got the first time that I got Logic Pro, and had a laptop and had that software, and it was the first time that I could kind of execute ideas that I had in my head, and I could build, you know, rather than just writing a single line of melody, I could layer it and I could start adding arrangements and other parts. And that was just when I would spend loads of time in between projects and in between takes, in my trailer, just kind of, you know, writing music and laying down music. And that's what I do in my hotel. And I mean, that was like what I used to do. But I just never really, it took me a while to ever think about kind of doing anything with that. You know, I just thought that it was just a hobby.
Well, I can imagine what it would have been like you said, men taking things through customs. I spoke to Rami Van Kesteren, who's a famous harpist, and that's one of the most difficult things to take through customs. And he's a performing musician, so, but
yeah,
more on that later. You know, it's funny, I notice, you know, we mentioned your husband a second ago, and I can see your Zoom tag is clearly not Amelia.
I steal up his rig. I just use his he's always having to do so much press. So I'm like, I just sneak in and use his setup.
Well, going from one extreme to the other, you know, I, not having been an actor, I can't claim to know what it feels like to have such anxiety. But the other half of the coin, it seems like your husband has zero qualms about being in front of the camera. Did he ever talk to you about the issues? Can you guys commiserate on that aspect?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't acting anymore by the time we were together. So when we met, I was already making music. So I didn't, you know, I wasn't in that space, that place anymore. But we definitely talked about it. And actually, you know, he very much like struggles with that sometimes. And, you know, he's not always the most comfortable, like in the spotlight, weirdly. So, you know, he gets it. But he's kind of found a way of navigating it, you know?
Yeah, he sure has. So, Wild Mountain Time, it's, like I said, it's a very, very pleasant, story. It warms you. I think that's what, you know, if there was any year that society and the world needed a little bit of warmth, it's this year. But can you talk to us about the selection of music, the discussions with the director about what was wanted versus what your vision was and maybe how they coalesced?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think you're right in terms of the warmth of the film, and that was one of the things that really hooked me into it. And I do think it's a, you know, it's a kind of film where you can't have any cynicism. Like, you have to leave all that at the door. You have to just kind of be in. You have to just be like, I'm in, I buy it, I'm in this world, and I love it, you know? And so I think for some people won't want to do that, and that's fine. But when I read the script, I just was in, and I just felt like I want to be part of this world, this heightened kind of reality. And I just loved the characters, and I really had like a very emotional response to the script that I couldn't deny. And I just, it was like very, very powerful. And so I had kind of lots of initial ideas, and wrote some themes kind of straight off the bat from reading the script, and wrote some stuff for Jamie, actually, just for him to have, like, personally as a kind of Anthony theme for his character. And, you know, I was just really inspired. I just wanted to write music when I read the script. And then, you know, I shared some of the music, and the director and the producer were really, really, you know, supportive and really liked my work. But then, and actually I can say this now because I read something that John has said this, but he basically he said, look, I really like her work, but she's Jamie's wife and I can't fire her, so I let's, you know, move on. So then they kind of moved on, and they, you know, a lot of time passed, and then I got a phone call from him just saying, you know, we really want you to do it. And they kind of had a couple of the things I'd written early on had kind of been on the music as temp, and I think that it had kind of worked really well. And I think they just, you know, they just maybe got used to it and kind of, and it just became part of the film. And so, yeah, so he kind of said, look, you know, I can't fire you, so it's a big responsibility, and you have to do a good job. And so that was that. And then once we started working together, quite a bit of the groundwork was done because of these, you know, things that I'd already written, and some of them were working really well, some of them weren't, and we kind of let them go. But it was very clear what was working and what wasn't working when I saw the film. And then it was just kind of, you know, I had a really strong sense of how I felt the music should be. And I felt like I wanted it to have some really strong melodic themes, like a really old-fashioned movie score with kind of big melodic hooks that really kind of stay with you. And you know, and I think that, you know, Shanley felt the same way, and we were all kind of on the same page. And then there were a couple of wild cards, you know, the whole sequence, the phone call and open the shutters. There's that bit, you know, with the with the two of them, and she's on the horse and he's got the metal detector, and there's all this kind of drama. And that was really, really fun to write, and I loved it. And that was the temp music on there. It was The Flying Dutchman, and which is obviously like an incredible piece of music. And I knew that John was really in love with it and that it was working really, really well. So it kind of felt like this weird challenge where I was just like, right, okay, what am I going to do to like get The Flying Dutchman off this cue, you know? And that was how I kind of approached it. I was like, just go big. Like, you can't go too big with it. Just like full melodrama madness. And it was just, and I just remember Shani saying, like, go further, push it further. You've got to frighten yourself. And I was like, okay. And I had so much fun with that cue. And it was really different to anything I'd kind of written before. And then there was also just all the kind of trad Irish music that I wanted to flavor the score. And I wanted it to have a kind of, just inject a bit of energy into it without going down anything that felt too too twee or too kind of, you know, I don't know, too polished. Like, I wanted it to have a bit of life and character as well.
Usually when an artist or a musician is able to get a film score responsibility, they kind of have from title card to end credits, but you had to kind of shoehorn your music in between two big songs in the film. Did that help or hurt, or what was the creative hurdle for that?
I actually quite liked it and found it quite helpful in a way, because we had these two really strong, you know, things. We had Swan Lake and then the Wild Mountain Time folk song, and they both are so beautiful in their own ways. And I was really, I loved that song, the Wild Mountain Time. There's a Kate Rusby version of it that, I mean, I listened to so much in my 20s. And so I really love that song, and I find it like very moving. And then Swan Lake is obviously Swan Lake, so it's this kind of incredibly beautiful, dramatic, recognizable music. And I kind of, knowing that those two things were there, the film already had like a really strong musical identity. And so then I felt like my job was kind of to almost to bridge them, you know, and to kind of have something that felt really sweeping and lush and beautiful, but then also that had the charm and the heart of the folk song. So it was trying to kind of marry the two things. But it was quite, in a way, it was quite nice that like some of those moments were, you know, already had their thing. So it kind of was less intimidating in some ways.
Okay. Well, the way I describe it is it's kind of Pride and Prejudice by way of Lord of the Rings. So it feels like what you did is your score took a curve through Middle Earth and came back to Northern Ireland and picked up a few epic flourishes along the way. One of the great things about a musician is they're able to, you know, they would interpret the story kind of like you did reading the script, and their music is in turn an interpretation of what they think this music should sound like. So is there sort of a line you need to toe to say, if we do an accordion, it's not Northern Irish music, or if I throw in another instrument, it doesn't make it unique or genuine anymore?
What you mean in terms of like keeping the authenticity of how it should be in terms of what an actual setup would be in an Irish band kind of thing?
Precisely.
Right.
So if you interpret Irish is one way and maybe the locals in the pub say that's not Irish music, you know, how do you get to the end goal?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are just so many different kinds of Irish music that I think, you know, when I've been in Ireland, I've seen so many different setups and different instrumentation and different, you know, I think there's quite a lot of space within that. It's not too rigid. And maybe if I went into lots of detail, maybe there would be people saying, well, you wouldn't have had that instrument in that part of Ireland. And I'm sure that there are lots of things like that. But as the movie's contemporary, I kind of felt like there was, you know, an allowance to, you know, have our own sound almost, although it was very much based on the kind of trad bands, and you know, I listen to a lot of trad music. But then I also wanted it to feel kind of bedded in the orchestra as well. So we used clarinets, which probably aren't traditional in an Irish band, but we had, you know, two clarinets, an accordion, two fiddle players, and a bass. So it was definitely an unusual setup, but I felt like that was the best way of kind of marrying the orchestral cues and the band, because a lot of the time they're both being used in cues, so it wasn't kind of as clear cut as like a band in a pub and then the orchestra. Like, it was kind of mixing the two. So I think that it's probably slightly different setup to what you would find in Ireland, but then there's lots of bands that I listened to that had really interesting different kind of instrumentation and arrangements and setups. So I think it's quite open.
Well, when you started out on the score, did you ever think you would be writing a theme for a barn? I just took a look at the track list, you know, listening to it.
Cowshed. It's a cowshed.
Cowshed. Oh, even worse or better? I don't know.
We should have come up with a better name for that cue. I mean, it's like the first time you see them together, like, why did we call it cowshed? It's so weird. It's like the names you give cues when you're working on them often end up just being the names of the cues. Like, you never go back and when you're doing the album go, should we rename that? It's such a weird process, because actually the names are really strange, but they're just based on like a shorthand with me and the orchestrator going, oh, you know, the cowshed scene or the this scene. And then they just stay with those silly names.
Maybe you should have just left it 1M2 or something, like the session. So going back to the accents, you know, there's so many dialects in even in Northern Ireland. When you're composing and you're watching a scene, do you try to, I don't know how to ask this, but is there a way to put an accent on a type of music? You know, like we talked about, you're making it more modern. You're giving it almost an Amelia accent as opposed to a true in the wool. I don't know what I'm saying.
No, I like it. I know what you mean. I think that there's definitely a way of like trying to give it like a unique voice, you know, and like a character or something, and try and infuse the music with like this kind of spirit or character of what, you know, of the movie and the world of that movie. And I think there was definitely a way of doing it. I think the main thing that I found gave me that was using the accordion a lot, because the characters are really odd, you know, and they're really unusual people. And I think that sometimes just having underscore or having kind of cues just really with kind of straight strings and orchestra, it just didn't quite capture for me the essence of the film. And then kind of putting accordion in with these beautiful string section just gave it this this unique sound, I think. And so that was definitely a way of kind of infusing it and trying to give it its own accent, I guess, instead of just having it completely straight.
Well, taking that a bit further, you know, once you find your voice or once you find your groove in the score, I imagine things just become easy. And then whether you can make your contributions to the score additive or subtractive based on what's happening on screen, what do you think maybe was the easiest part or the part in the score where you said, okay, now I've got it, this theme is, you know, I can see the finish line?
Yeah, so there was there was definitely like a moment where I felt like I broke the code or something, like something just kind of happened where I wrote the cue. I think it's called I Can't Sell, and it's when Rosemary's mother is kind of put into an ambulance, and then there's a scene in the hospital, and then it's like a big montage. It's a really beautiful part of the film, and then, you know, she dies and you see Rosemary's character at the graveyard, and then there's this like beautiful voiceover where Tony talks about seeing Aoife on her wedding day and she was the most beautiful bride, and you see her closing the shutters and then she kind of disappears, and it's like a really beautiful moment. And and I was really intimidated by it because it's like, you know, it's a big piece of, you know, it's like 3.5 minutes or something of music, and the music is going to be really central. And because the film's very dialogue heavy, and actually there's not that many moments where there's no dialogue. So, but I kind of wrote this this thing very, very quickly. It was like the first thing I wrote, and I just kind of wrote it at the piano and then sat and watched it to the picture, and it just worked. And I was like, and it was quite different to the stuff I'd been writing on the other cues. And the only thing that I'd written on the piano, you know, with a piano, and I just was like, I feel that that's the, I just felt very like, that's it. That's it. That's the sound of the film. And that's like the soul of the film. But I remember saying to my orchestrator, I sent it to him and I was like, this is just going to be this like one moment that you hear this piece. It's going to be a standalone, like beautiful piano piece. And that's the only time you're going to hear it. It's just for this section. And he was like, I really like that idea. That's really cool. And we sent it off, and then the director John just was like, this is the theme, and I want to hear it on this cue, and can we try it here, and can we, and he kept suggesting all this stuff, and I was like, what, like it's not going to work on that scene, are you crazy, like this is, you know, this is the Aoife theme, this is, you know. And then actually I went and I did what he asked, and he was right, and the film just really loved this cue, and it just kind of worked in all different, you know, it worked in a kind of joyful way, in a hopeful way, in a sad way, and it just was like this magic salve that I just kind of found. And once we had that, it really was just like unlocking the film, and it was, and then that cue is used, you know, maybe six times throughout the film, and is like the big one at the front, you know, the big end, and it ended up kind of growing and growing and becoming its own thing. So that was really interesting to watch happen. When I wrote that cue, I didn't imagine that it would appear all through the score and becomes like the backbone of the score. I had no idea. It was really interesting the way that it happened.
Well, I remember speaking to Henry Jackman, and he was working on Big Hero 6 a number of years ago for Disney. And he just said, first thing he did was he just locked himself in his studio in his room, and he just wrote the Big Hero 6 theme for about a week. And like you said, you can, when a theme's working, you can take it through the iterations and variations. It can be sad. It can be triumphant. Yeah. It could be, you know, mournful.
Totally.
But what's the most exciting thing to you when you're working? Is it the germ of an idea? Is it getting the approval from the director? Is it seeing it performed live? What gives you the most inspiration and excitement?
I think there are all sorts of different really special moments throughout the process. It's kind of the initial, you know, excitement when you're going to work, when you know you've got the job and you're going to work on the project, and that's like thrilling and really exciting and then really scary. And then there's the kind of thing where you write the first kind of cue, or the first couple of cues, and they work, and that's really amazing. And then for me, there's always like this moment before you send anything. So like if you're working on something and you've done something that you think works really, really, really well, and you're so proud of it, and then there's this kind of magic moment where like no one else has seen it, and it's just yours in that, for that minute, it's just yours. And then you send it off, and they either say, we love it, or they say, we like this, but we don't like this, or they say, we hate it, and then just throw it away. I always find like there's this moment where it's just like reality kicking in, or any criticism, and it's just this really lovely private moment. And then sometimes you get the feedback, which is, we love it, don't change it, and that's just the best feeling ever. But that doesn't always happen, so it's like you've got to send it off knowing, okay, that might be the last time I see it like that, because you know I'll have to take on board all the notes. So I really love that. And then I think that when you record the music is the best, you know, the best day, when you actually have the musicians, and you know, as much as you know how it's going to sound and you've mocked it up really well, and you know, it's never, every single time I'm astonished at how different it sounds with live musicians. Like it never fails to blow me away when you hear it played by amazing musicians, and it's just, oh, it's just the best feeling.
Fair enough. Going back to In Wild Mountain Time, the idea of trying to work within the songs, you know, the James Bond's franchise is known very well for that. They have the title song, and then elements of that song are kind of peppered and woven through the score, which helps make each film its own individual entity. Do you have any advice to young composers who might have to do something like that, or like you had to work between Swan Lake and Wild Mountain Time?
I mean, I guess it depends how. I mean, we did like initially when I first came up with, there were conversations about, do we try and bring elements of Swan Lake into the score? Do we try and kind of have the Russian ballet sound? Do we try and somehow weave that in? And then actually it felt like it needed to be a separate thing, and it needed to be its own thing, and you know, and almost like it's at the inside of Rosemary's head, so it didn't need to be in the rest of the world of the film. And then with Wild Mountain Time, the song, there are a couple of moments in the score that, you know, that the song comes in and is scored. But we kind of just, those moments were pretty much decided very, you know, very early on. And they were like, I think maybe when I came on, the song was used more, and but it felt like to me and you know, and everyone else that it was just too much at that point. So I think we kind of ended up just keeping it in a couple of kind of key moments. And then trying to, but I just wanted to, I definitely was very aware when I wrote that kind of opening theme that it could go easily in and out of Wild Mountain Time, you know, and I was aware of like the melody and how easy it could be to kind of come out of my theme into that and out of that into my theme. So it was definitely something that I kind of was, you know, aware of. But I didn't really have to kind of, you know, build it into the score anywhere else. But I suppose because it's such a beautiful, strong melody, I knew I wanted my own really strong melody that could kind of counter, you know, balance that we could have alongside it. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think every job is so unique and everything just has to be so bespoke that it really just depends on the project and how much, you know, you want to be integrating things in or how close they need to be, or I think that's just project to project, it's going to be different.
Well, as piano is an extension of you and what you're able to bring to a film, it gives it a lot of heart. Do you try anything interesting with the piano? Do you have any techniques that you like you said, every project is different, so it depends on the needs of the story. But have you tried anything wild with the piano, opening it up, hitting it with a kid's baseball bat or something weird?
I've done some of that actually on my last EP. We kind of had it open and we did some stuff with the strings, and I've definitely used like the reverb inside it and stuff. I mean, I think the way I play piano is kind of weird anyway and unique, because I can't really, you know, I'm not classically trained. I don't have an academic background, and I play the piano by ear and by memory. So everything I write, I can only play it from memory. So it's kind of a ridiculous, not very efficient way of working, but it's just how it is for me. And I can't. So when I sit at the piano, I'm usually, I'm just looking for patterns with my hands, and that's kind of how I write, is just finding patterns rather than ever kind of, you know, actually I say that, but then if I'm working specifically on a film, then there will often be melodies that just appear in my head, you know, when I'm in bed or going for a walk, and then I will have to work them out on the piano. But usually if I'm just sitting at the piano completely, you know, with nothing, with a clean page, I always just start looking at trying to create a pattern of some kind.
Well, that's amazing, because that does make it unique to you and, you know, strengthens your voice and character as an artist. Moving forward, it seems like you have a lot more confidence. It seems like that you found your calling, giving the acting world a fond goodbye. What do you have lined up, and I hope this isn't too personal of a question. Do you have similar anxieties about getting a cue approved or working on a film that you had acting? Is this truly more comfortable?
Oh no, yeah, it's such a much better fit. And no, I don't have anxiety beyond just what you would expect when you're working on something and there's pressure and you want to get it right. And, you know, but it's completely manageable and it's fine. And I think that what's really nice about writing film music is that it's kind of, it's functional music. So it's serving a purpose. So for me to be precious or to have too much ego or to get upset if something isn't working, it just doesn't make any sense, because, you know, why the reason a cue works is that there are so many reasons why a cue works. It's not just because it's beautiful or because it's a, you know what I mean, a good piece of music. It has to work to picture and it has to be serving all of these functions. And I think that because of that, there's like a separation that I feel. So I don't take things personally. I don't worry if it's not working. I don't worry about me or, you know, it's all about the film and what's right for the film. So no, I don't. I feel really comfortable. I feel like it's a really good fit and I love the collaboration and I love, you know, getting to work with other artists and kind of how it crosses over into different fields. So no, I don't. But I mean, I still definitely have, you know, if you said to me, oh, you have to go and perform, you know, your music, I would have all of those anxieties would come back for sure. You know, I've had to do a couple of little things like that. And I find it really hard to do that.
Well, over the years, I've spoken to innumerable amount of composers, and I have not met a single one who says, yes, I love listening to my music. Because usually the response is, I'll pick it apart or I'll think about what I was doing and whatever it is. Christmas season is right upon us. Whether or not you listen to your own music, can you clear your head after a project so that you stop thinking about why I did this? Can you go into Christmas feeling free of Wild Mountain Time? Or is it going to stay with you for a little bit?
Good question. That's insightful, because it's funny. I was thinking that today. I was thinking, you know, even though it's out and it's finished, I still feel very much, you know, it still feels very present to me. You know, and I think because I actually didn't write it that long ago. I only wrote it. We recorded it at the end of August. So in some ways it still feels quite fresh. And I haven't had that kind of cycle of time to really move on from it. But yeah, I mean, I think that Christmas will be a natural break. And then, you know, there's something I'm going on to work on in January. So now I'm just trying to exactly kind of just get clear headed, get everything out, get kind of a fresh start and make space for the next thing, which will be fun. But it's weird. I find it sad, like moving on from projects sometimes, you know, especially because that was just such a lovely joy to work on it. And I had such a great time. And I felt the same way when I did Mary Shelley. And I was really sad leaving that, the world of Mary Shelley. And I didn't, you know, I wanted to keep writing that music for those characters. So I think it's always a kind of weird, bittersweet thing. But yeah, I'm sure that it will kind of, you know, I'll move on eventually.
Okay. Well, speaking of Christmas, do you have a couple favorite movies or scores to that you and your family celebrate, or you're eager to just dive into?
Well, look, I'm a Christmas, you know, person. I love Christmas, so I'm. You know, I'm all over all of it, like all of the movies. I listen to, I think like the Elvis Presley Christmas album is probably my favorite. But like lots of Bing Crosby and all of the kind of classic, beautiful, you know, White Christmas. And then we've already done, I mean, I feel like we put up our tree at the end of November. We've gone really early this year with all of it. We've already done like Elf, Home Alone, what did we just watch? I just watched The Christmas Chronicles, which I hadn't seen before, which is amazing. A Miracle on
34th
is fourth? Yeah, I was like fifth, fourth. Fourth Street was my favorite as a kid. Like that was my, you know, I watched that every year. And then I've got these other films that I watch every Christmas, but they're not Christmas films, but to me they are. So Oliver Twist, I love, and watch that every Christmas. And also Little Women, the Elizabeth Taylor one. to the one that was done in 1949. Oh my God. And the score to that is so beautiful. And to me, that's like my ultimate Christmas film, even though it's, you know, it's just, it just tends to be shown at Christmas. So I've got that association. So I love that. And then I also love The Nightmare Before Christmas would be up there, and especially for scores. Like, I just, you know, Danny Elfman is the absolute, I mean, he's just brilliant. And I love that film. And I got to watch that with my kids this year, and it was like the first year that I felt they wouldn't be too scared. And that was really fun. What else? I mean, I love them all. I mean, I think Home Alone is like one of the best movie scores. It's just that, you know, that theme is just so wonderful.
Sure, yeah. Somewhere in My Memory and everything, he takes like Indiana Jones, Harry Potter, a Hook, and just kind of dials it into this, what would have been a throwaway comedy, but it's become a classic, an icon, cultural touchstone.
Yeah, absolutely. It's brilliant. It's really great.
Have you seen Rise of the Guardians?
No, I haven't.
It's technically an Easter movie, but it's, there's a Santa Claus in it. There's all these...
my kids, they were watching this a couple of weeks ago, and I hadn't heard of it, but it looks kind of amazing. It's a great idea.
Yeah, and I think Alexandre Desplat's score is just, it's one of the best things he's ever done. So again, an Easter movie, but you could enjoy it this time of year.
Okay, I'll definitely be watching that.
Well, great. Do you do accents? Do you and your husband trade accents?
No, it's really frustrating because I'm actually a really good mimic, and it's one thing that I can do really well. But I can't do him, and it drives me crazy. I can't do the Belfast thing. It's such a difficult dialect to get. Like, it's so weird. Eventually one day I'll get it, but I'm not there yet.
I saw a Vanity Fair, there's a series of videos from Vanity Fair where actors teach people their native tongue, and one of the words he had was faffin, which means kind of wasting your time. So he said something to the effect of, you know, quit faffing about. And of course I screwed that up, but it was pretty funny. Well,
I need to watch that. I need to be taught.
Well, Amelia, happy Christmas. Best to you and your family this holiday season, and good luck in a prosperous 2021. Thank you for being a guest on our show.
Thank you so much, and have a lovely Christmas.